prodigality of this 46th chapter of Alma leaves my poor old noggin bemused. I don't know how to handle it. I made a list last night of 26 points of evidence it brings out. There are 16 of them. There, any one of which is would be enough to write a book about. So just now, before the class, the question occurs to me, and it's very important for us to answer it here. Is our main interest here proving the Book of Mormon? Are we interested in proving the Book of Mormon? Brother Monty Jensen, do you think so? Brother Jensen here? Is your main interest in the Book of Mormon proving it? Is your main interest in the Book of Mormon proving that it is true, that it's a real history?
No, I don't believe it.
Well, then what is your main interest in the Book of Mormon?
Learn more about what?
That's the point, you see. People make that same thing about the Bible. Whether it's true or not, or whether it's a myth or not, it has great lessons for us. They say that. Well, the Book of Mormon certainly has great lessons, but it has always been the main issue whether it's true. If the book is a fraud, the famous critic of the 20s and 30s, Bernard DeVoto, who was born in Utah, but he edited the Atlantic Monthly, I think it was, for years, and he characterized the Book of Mormon as a yeasty fermentation of nonsense, unspeakably absurd. Well, is it that? You see, it's obviously he hadn't read it. Later on, he apologized for it. He read a chapter, and it changed his mind. But no, I'm not fooling here, as far as that goes. But it can't be proven, you see, as far as that goes. It was the editor, religious editor of the Los Angeles Times. He came down and interviewed some people here, and he asked me, what eminent archaeologist has ever been forced to believe the Book of Mormon by the evidence? You're not going to twist anybody's arm. After all, angels are not scientific, see? And anyone who pretends to be a scientist in his profession is not going to accept angels unless he's forced to, you see? You have to have evidence so powerful that it would force any archaeologist or anthropologist to believe it. And you're never going to find that, are you? But then the answer to that question is, what on earth does anybody know today about what was happening in the New World 2,000 BC is bad enough. But 2,000 years ago, you can find remnants from which you might reconstruct this, that, or the other, but we have no record, no written record, no names, no. We know nothing. We know nothing that was going on in the Book of Mormon days. You dig, and then you compare what you found here with what you dug up somewhere else, and then you argue about how to account for the resemblances and so forth. You never get anywhere. Archaeology is not a science at all. Of course, you just dig and you guess. But they haven't got very far. You have to admit, we're not going to get very far with evidence here, are we? Well, now let's see somebody else now. Well, if it's true, it could still be a great book, couldn't it? We've seen that. But then, religion, what does religion teach us? Sister Matthews here? Yes, what does religion teach us? Well, to read, say, for the Bible or the Book of Mormon, what are the religious teachings of the Bible and the Book of Mormon?
It teaches about one word to what
we should do, what. See, really comes to the point, why we were here, what purpose, and so forth. But this is what, unless it's true, you see, unless the Bible is true and those stories are true and so forth, what is it doing? Philosophy teaches those things. That's what you think about in philosophy. Though you came nearer the point. Most people today say, including most ministers, that the Bible teaches us morals and ethics and aesthetics and principles and spiritual things and beautiful stories. They teach us love and affection, family, those things. It teaches us all those things. But you don't have to go to the Bible. You don't have to have angels come to tell you that, you see. It needs no ghost come from the dead, my Lord, to tell us that, as Horatio says. No, we don't have to have those. We have thousands of books on that subject. The whole fourth floor of the library is taken up with subjects that will tell you about humanity and love and morals and human nature and all that sort of thing. No, the only purpose of religion is to answer one question, and Sister Matthews came very near to it. Just one question. That's the terrible question. It's called the terrible question. Nobody could answer. Well, I used to talk a lot about that. The question is this all there is? If this is the whole show, we're in an entirely different... See, if this is the whole show, then you're your whole way of life is going to be arranged differently, isn't it? If this is all there is, then remember what Korihor teaches in the Book of Mormon? When the man dies, that was the end thereof. Therefore, they lifted their heads and rejoiced. They could sin all they wanted to. There would be no reckoning or anything like that. And they were glad of that teaching, that when the man dies, that is the end thereof. Well, that will pretty well determine your behavior, won't it? The only question, is that all there is? Now, pure fantasy can teach us wisdom and, say, morals, kindness, courage, forgiveness, moral things. We have stories, we tell stories in Sunday school and so forth. Von Van Dyke, it was very popular in the 1920s to invent sentimental religious stories and things like that. The little engine that could and things like that. We give those a Sunday school lesson. Well, their morals are fine. You give them in primary and the like. But we're talking about the real thing now. Now, take a great fantasies like the Midsummer Night's Dream or The Tempest. Midsummer Night's Dream ends with a blessing on the house. It's a beautiful thing. A blessing on the house and peace, and I have come to the world before to sweep the dust beneath the door. But it is pronounced by Puck, a sprite, a mythical sprite. There's nothing there. And then that other play of great fantasy and power, his last play, you see, teaches all sorts of moral lessons, the main lesson being the lesson of forgiveness. And how does it end? Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and have dissolved in air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the gorgeous towers, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all that it inherit shall dissolve. And like this unsubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are the stuff that dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. There's nothing before. And after this, it will all just vanish. It's just a play. It's just a presentation. The whole life is. And it won't leave even a rack. A rack is the clouds, the torn clouds that remain after a storm. Won't even leave that behind. It's all going away and leave nothing. And most people believe that's what it is. That makes a difference, you see. So it's very important, this business. Claudio sums it up. Another speech that's in Shakespeare gives the opinion, the final word on the subject of death. Oh, they left my cup here. I think that's good. Now, this is providing. This is good stuff here. At the bar. What'll it be, folks? But Claudio sums it up in the prison. He doesn't want to die for his sister. So he says, "Aye, but to die and go we know not where. To lie in cold obstruction and to rot." Nice prospect. "This sensible war motion to become a kneaded clod." Or then he says, "And the delighted spirit to bathe in fiery floods." Now these are the various prospects of the hereafter that religion held forth in Shakespeare's day. To bathe in fiery floods, or to reside in thick ribbed regions, in thrilling regions of thick ribbed ice. See, the worst hell of all, the center of hell in Dante, is not the fire, it's not the flame, it's ice. Everything freezes, it's the heat death. Everything is absolutely cold, it reaches absolutely zero, and that's where it all ends. Well, of course, that's the second law. Everything's running down. First law, of course, heat can't go from a cooler to a hotter body. It always runs downhill, and so that's where it is in Dante. In thrilling regions of thick ribbed ice. Or to be born... Yes, or to be born with restless violence. No, oh, to be imprisoned in the viewless winds, and born with and blown with restless violence round the pendant earth. You see. Or worse than worse. Now he brings up the new doctrine of purgatory, which was the worst of all, worse than worst of those, whom lawless. And what is it? Whom lawless and unminds imagine howling. 'Tis too horrible. I think of that in a second. Imagine howling. 'Tis too horrible. The weariest and most loathed worldly life that age, ache, penury, and imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we think of death, you see. The worst thing that can happen to us, the worst loathed earthly life, that age, ache, penury, imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we fear of death. The worst of See, that, the doctrine of purgatory is not an old one. It's not an ancient one. It was introduced in modern times, in Shakespeare's day, as a matter of fact. That, he thinks, is the worst of all, the most horrible. Remember, in Hamlet, he says, if I told you what happened there, it would freeze your young blood, cause every particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine, and Corforce. Oh, I could, list, he said, I could a tale unfold, the lightest word of which would freeze your blood, freeze your young blood. So it's hard, man can't think of anything, well, this is the issue after all, then, isn't it? It's the whole thing. And so, the plates and the angel, how do you explain them? Well, they're a hallucination. That's what the great Edward Meyer said, and he had more respect for Joseph Smith than any of them. They're a hallucination, but the trouble is the Book of Mormon is not a hallucination. It makes all the difference also if he really saw the angel, where he got that book, you see. Angels' visits always mean rejoicing. It's a breakthrough, you see. There is more. You never dreamed about it, but this is just the beginning. It's a great show, and you have been shortchanging yourself. You've been living in these confounds, cooped, cabin, crib, confound, bind in by saucy doubts and fears. You've been living like that? No, that's no good. But now an angel comes through, and that's a real thing, the real angel. This makes all the difference if he really saw it. And that means we're living under wholly different circumstances from the lives of quiet desperation that we normally live, and nobody can escape it. The merely reality of the Book of Mormon puts everything in a different light. You can accept it as a moral doctrine and teaching and this sort of thing, but that isn't it. I say, they're a dime a dozen. You can turn out more. Well, the editorial's in the paper every day. Somebody moralizes and points us the way of righteousness and condemns sin and folly and human misbehavior and the human comedy. We never get away, go around in it. But this means we don't need drugs to escape from the dawn of nothing, you see. That's the trouble, you see. Another recitation. The Rubaiyat. Lots of verses in the Rubaiyat about this. Of course, we used to learn this when I was in high school. It was the most negative thing in the world. But one moment in annihilation's waste, that's all we have. One moment of the wine of life to taste. The stars are setting, and the caravan starts for the dawn of nothing. Oh, make haste. Hurry while you're here, because you don't have much time, you see. And that's all there is. It's the dawn of nothing after this. So let's turn to this. Now, we were talking about one thing here, the list, I say, I listed them as 16 of them. Why 16? Because, and I'm not including the remarkable resemblance to our own time and the remarkable relevance to our own situation with which this chapter begins. Remember, 15th chapter, the post-war boom, then the arrogance of the people, then divided in, and then this cultural difference here. The main issue in the Book of Mormon is not between, did I mention this the last time, is not between the Nephites and the Lamanites at all. That's not the fight. Well, this is an important thing. This is our first point in this cultural thing here. But between totally different ways of life that began already in Jerusalem. There is the two. You notice Alma, like Nephi and Lehi and Ammon and Abinadi and the rest, you find these men we talked about, the Rechabites, who want to live the old law in its purity. And in this wicked and sophisticated civilization, you can't do it. So there's always this conflict. You see, Alma is over-strict. He is a prude, really. He gets on your nerves. No wonder he caused his second son, Alma, to revolt. But they have to be. These people, remember, it tells us in the short books, in Enos and so on, unless our laws were severely, extremely strict and severe, the only way we could keep things under control at all, you see, like the Puritan settlements in New England, they had to be extra severe. So it's the conflict between them and the more permissive way of life that the Nehors immediately introduced under, and that became the state religion. The righteous, the people of the church, are always a small minority, except for 200 years, throughout the Book of Mormon. They are the minority, and they're in constant conflict with these others, like Korihor, and the Nehor and Zizrom and so forth. Leaders are always able to get a big following if they protested against this overly strict religious society in which they were living here. So they lived the Rechabite, the old strict law and the prophets and so forth. It was austere living. It was the life of the mind. And they took to the wilderness. Every time there was a break, what they do is take to the wilderness. It repeats very often here. And the confusion of the Dead Sea Scrolls people, we mentioned them the last time, they did the same thing, you see. They left Jerusalem was corrupt, The scrolls are full of this, you see. And they were waiting there for the prophets. They were waiting for God, as it tells us in Isaiah. We've gone into the desert to make way, a way for the Lord, to prepare the way for the Lord to come. And we can only do that by preparing ourselves, that we might have visitations by angels and so forth. They were looking forth to that sort of thing. And the confusion of the people of Qumran, all up and down the Dead Sea. There wasn't just Qumran, I see. This was the standard religion of Lehi's day. And that was lost, you see, and that's why it's not popular today. That's why they suppressed the scrolls, actually. But this was the... And it's very natural to confuse them with the Essenes, because the Essenes were another such body of people that were going out of the world. But after all, St. Anthony, a rich Christian fellow living in Alexandria, Christian Alexandria, 100%, he saw it was a terrible way. He retreated to the desert and founded the monastic movement. We have to go out to the wilderness and purify things, and the confusion... There are many such groups. This is the whole Hermetic tradition. They form these conventicles, these groups. That would include Pythagoras. That would include the Platonic schools of teaching. Everyone who wanted to live a pure life, to get away from the corruption of the world, which always follows the same routine, the four things that Nephi talks about: people after fame, money, power, popularity, and the lusts of the flesh. Those are the things we all want to enjoy. This is repeated a number of times in the Book of Mormon, and Nephi makes it very clear. And it's right at the end of 2 Nephi there, isn't it? 22nd chapter and 23rd verse there at the end, and where he lists the four. And I say there are many groups. They're always doing this, breaking off and so forth. They keep breaking off of this church. Groups do that, going out to Baker and places like that. There have been many, many splinter groups from the church. Russell Rich devoted many years to studying those groups, and they amount to over 100 of them. Well, now, so that's, we have this theme that runs through the Book of Mormon, which is very solidly backed up now by the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then, in contrast to this, the other culture is that of Amalickiah. Now, that's a giveaway. Now we're getting to a piece of evidence here, a possible one. There's a second point here. The name Amalickiah. He is a leader, he sets himself up, and they all follow. His name, Amalickiah, is, my king is Jehovah. Now, Amalickiah was a Amulekite, and we forget that Zarahemla wasn't a Nephite city at all. It was a Amulekite city. And the Amulekites were a mixed band, much larger than Nephi's, that came over when Jerusalem fell after. They were led, we know now from the Lachish letters, that the youngest member of the royal family did escape, and he would be Mulek, the little king. They call themselves the Amulekites because he led their particular group and so forth. This is a possibility. But he represents the Amulekite reaction against the strict teachings of Lehi, Nephi's descendants. See, the Amulekites were never that way. They not only built the big city of Zarahemla, but they were almost all your dissenters, just as some of your greatest men. Ammon was a pure descendant. He was a Amulekite. He was a descendant of Zenith. The Amulekite king, I say, this was a mixed batch. They had no objections to accepting the foreign Mosiah as king. He was a Nephite. He became their king, you see. But then Mosiah and Alma take over, and they rule the state, practically. They lay down the law, and they're very strict, both of them. But you notice they do keep the law of Benjamin. Mosiah keeps the law of Benjamin. This is the second Mosiah. The law of Benjamin, which was the liberal law of the old law of Moses, namely, as it tells us in the 30th chapter of Alma, absolute freedom of speech and of religion. Notice Alma's own son started deliberately making all sorts of trouble, but they didn't lock him up, though he was head of the church. And Mosiah's four sons joined him, and they made as much trouble as they could. Wiseacre, see, they represented this easygoing, this more popular religion, and you'd think, well, why don't these two men crack down and put them in jail? It says because there was a law against, well, in the 30th chapter here, against any man's religion. Nobody could be, if a man, well, I'll read it to you because it's a very important law here. So they were free to do this. So you're going to have these two societies and two cultures, two ideals side by side here. Let me read you in Alma 30 here. Yes. Now, there was no law against a man's belief, for it was strictly contrary to the commands of God that there should be a law that should bring men on unequal grounds. Pressure groups, you'd come under pressure, you see, if you believed with a minority or something. There was no law. Now, if a man desired to serve God, it was his privilege. Or rather, if he believed in God, it was his privilege to serve him. But if he did not believe in him, there was no law to punish him. It was not a crime not to believe in God. Atheism had as much right as anybody else. See, otherwise it would have been unequal, it says. And so he says, now if the law of men should be judged according to their crimes, that's an overt action. She could be judged according to crimes. Nevertheless, there was no law against a man's belief. Therefore, a man was punished only for the crimes which he had done. Therefore, all men were on equal grounds. You know, pressures could be brought in that case, and so it goes. Now this Korihor had been raising hell, as you know, but they didn't imprison him. He went over. He was killed by the intolerant Zoramites. A Zoramite mob killed him there, but among the Nephites, he was free to circulate. And this Korihor, he went about in this, you know what he preached and so forth. And the law could have no hold on him. He began to preach unto the people that there should be no Christ. Foolish and vain hope to yoke yourself to foolish things. He says, this is not intellectual. This is foolish. It's not intellectually sound. Notice, these were the intellectuals, the rationalists, the positivists and so forth. These foolish old traditions, these old myths that have kept you down, and according to your own desires, they keep you down, even as it were in bondage. You may glut yourself with the labors at their hands. You durst not look up with boldness and durst not. He was allowed to preach all this. They durst not make use of that which was their own. They had to pay taxes and things like that. It was a sacral state, you see. Well, this was allowed and so forth. So you see these two states, these two cultures side by side. And this conflict is the one that hits you all the way through the Book of Mormon. See, we're so naive and so simplistic in the church. We just say, well, there were the good guys. Naturally, there were the Lamanites, the Nephites, who were white. And there were the dark people, which were the black, and there were the Lamanites. Well, it isn't that way at all. This is what the real issue is all throughout the... And so it's the issue in our world. Our war is not with the Lamanites today at all. So, and along with this, you notice, they're bound to resent Nephi and Levi and Almas and Mosiah's complete rule. Why should they be in charge? Why should he? It's all right to make him king. They did because he's a great man. But then when he was joined Alma, and he gave Alma plenary power in the church, people started objecting, and then there was this rebellion that became very popular. And the church from then on is a small minority. They don't hold their own at all. And along with this, there are frequent indications we'll see in the Book of Mormon of ancient and exotic peoples in the background. For example, when Alma went... Excuse me, I thought you were just bored, I see. When Alma went to visit the Zoramites on a mission, you see, they'd only been away from the central culture. They descended, as you know, and went out for a short period. And he says they were utterly dumbfounded. They were so amazed they didn't know what to think of it. It absolutely stunned them. It knocked them out. They had a totally different religion, a very exotic things in which you built high towers and stairways and all this sort of thing, and had prayers, and you loaded yourself with all sorts of costly and lavish apparel, and the priests prating around and so forth. Well, immediately we come into the world in which we're familiar from the murals and the vases and the reliefs of Central America and South America, the whole Mesoamerica, namely this lavish, strange religion. It was there before. The Zoramites took it up, obviously, almost overnight. They had this whole different culture. And they said we were completely amazed by what they found, how they changed everything. They kept some of the old religion. It says they adopted this, that, and the other. But who would give them this idea? You just don't invent a religion whole cloth that way, you see. They came out and they picked this up. And we find, and then the Seabus game, for example. This is a worldwide thing. And well, we don't go into these things, but it's another of these exotic things. We find constant hints about, well, when they talk about, for example, the land that was barren of trees because of the whole central country was barren of trees because of the inhabitants. We say, well, you can't make a desert that way, but you can. We know now that that's what started the Sahara going. I mean, that people do create deserts. They do deforest countries entirely. In fact, Plato talked about that. He says half the Peloponnesus is now just a desert because people have cut down the trees. Well, this had happened in the Book of Mormon here. And who are these people? It's not talking about the roving Jaredites in the North Country. We're talking about something else here. Well, anyway, this is an important thing. These contacts are mentioned only when necessary. This is why, you know, since the Book of Mormon is very carefully edited to focus attention intensely on the small minority of believers who remain true and faithful. It's the history of the church, you see. From father to son, it's handed down genealogically from father to son. As you know, it deals with the affairs of the church. And so Though throughout the Book of Mormon we find intense hostility between these two ways of life. One is strict and upright, the other is glorying in displays of wealth, fine apparel. Notice the language it uses, a lavish term. Fine apparel, proud cults of nobility. They're always talking, we saw that the last time. The very sort of thing we find so strikingly illustrated in the murals and vase painted and so forth. The tasteless profusion of the jewelry and the feathers and the parading of priests and the pride of these things and the buildings, they said, the exceeding high towers, which play an important part in the Book of Mormon and how they're built, who builds them under enforced labor and so forth. So we get this one then, and this is a striking point, and it comes out in this chapter very clearly. And then in this chapter, Moroni appeals to the folk memory of the ancient Hebrew customs and traditions. And here's something that is really quite solid here, and this refers us to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember, he talks about the banner that Moroni raises. It's to rally the people to assert their religion and their freedom. And we saw that so did Kaveh. That's the story of the Persian. It wasn't the Persian nation. It was, again, a society of these special people that went out to live the pure life, the Magi, you see. Not the Persian nation, the Iranian nation. That was under Drigvert, the Drigvert. That was the lord of the lie. And he was the one that had to be overcome. But the people that wanted to join Kaveh, when he put his leather apron, his working apron, on his pole and held it high and put an inscription on it, and he rallied all the people to him for their freedom, and they founded the freedom and the nation of the Magi, which was a separate chosen group. And remember, they figure in the Bible, too. Jews are very close to these particular people. And so it was also for their religion and their freedom and their national existence. And on the banner of Lehi, of Moroni, was the inscription, "For God, religion, freedom, wives, children." We should be following along here, shouldn't we? We have two books to follow. And this is the picture. But now we come to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we get it very concretely. This is the ideal war. It says, when the people shall return from the wilderness to Jerusalem, then there'll be a time of troubles, and then there'll be wars, and this is the way it will be fought. These are the rules of the sacred warfare prescribed for Judah at all times. But this is there's an argument whether this has to deal just with the last war at the last time, or this is the rule by which they were always supposed to govern their warfare. So when Israel went to war, we learned from the battle scroll, the IQM, the battle scroll. And we talked about, it's quite a coincidence that this was edited by Yigael Yadin, who I say was in Provo several times, and we had some nice long talks with him about this. And he is the not only the editor, but he was the general, the commander-in-chief in the 8 Days of War, in the first war in 1948. And he says, this was discovered in 1948, just on the eve of the war, and it fired the nation to great deeds. And they did these tremendous things. We mentioned the last time how two old Skoda guns from World War I were able to turn the tide of invasion. The strange things that happen. Well, the banner's the important thing here. And what they have to do, when they go out to war, it says you raise it. The high priest raises the banner. And I think the best thing to do is just to, in special instance, to read the general account that Alma gives, and then I've noted some things in the scrolls here. We have the text here, and this is the one we'll follow. It supplies us with the text. This is the sort of thing. Now, this says, one banner, you shall raise the banner, it says, when the B'nai Levi, with B'nai Yehuda, when the sons of Levi and the sons of Judah and the sons of Benjamin, those three tribes, you see, when they return from the wilderness, when they return from their captivity in the wilderness, they regard themselves as living in the wilderness as long as they're in a state of captivity and in the wicked world. That always the image of the B'shuv Goleth on the return from the captivity of the B'nai, or of the sons of light. They call themselves, it's called, the title of the book, you see, the scroll of the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. That's the way the world is divided, and this is a theme that's very, very notable in the Book of Mormon, too. Again, you talk about the light, especially Alma talks about this, you know. when he talks about his redemption, he sees it from the darkness to the light and so forth. Well, we go on. He talks about just the places I've marked here. And on the trumpets they shall inscribe those called of God, and Nesheviel, and those, the Nesi'uel, the princes of God, and the Serich'el, and the church of God. It means the order, the organization of God. This is, shall be on one. The Odoth, Othel, Le'etzeth, Kadosh. Ha! And this is, well, fortunately, Brother Yadin has supplied us with translation here. That helps, you know. But we agree very well on these things, needless to say. But it says, it's talking about the saints, the peace of God in the encampments of his saints. They call themselves the saints, you see. They're coming back, they're organizing themselves. And there, and then, as in Alma 46:13 here, he says, he shall write the peace of God in the encampment of his saints upon their trumpets, and they shall write God's mighty deeds to scatter the enemy and put to flight all the opponents of justice. And then here's a good one up here. Desolation. And now this doctrine of desolation is very important. He says here, I'm looking at 36 instead of 46. Notice, Alma, this is too good to miss here. Had them rend their garments, and he turns. Did I do it all? Well, I've done it already here. I don't know why I'm making all this fuss about it. When Israel went to war, the people were rallied by such inscriptions on the banners. The banner was called the Nes, N-E-S, which the lexicon will tell you means a pole, a flag, a standard, a signal, an assignment. Title is the best translation you could give that. A title puts the subject matter. The title is, it also says, remember, because it gave them title to the land. And the emphasis on the land is very important all the way through here. We asked Yadin, what is your religion? What do you believe in? Remember, he's an enlightened modern Jew. He says, my religion is the land. I believe in the land. And that was his religion, the Holy Land. This is obsession with the land. It's repeated again and again way back here. They still are. And the same thing here. The blessings upon the land. Alma talks about the promised land. And he says, to give us a title upon the land, this very closeness to the land they talk about. The idea of the promised land here. This is what happened. Let's read the thing here, here it is, in the 17th verse. He came to pass that he poured out his soul to God. He named all the land which was south of the land desolation. And in all the land on the north and the south, all the rest of the land, including some of the south lands, he called a chosen land and a land of liberty. Chosen land should have been capitalized, because that's exactly what the priest does here. Before the battle, he goes between the ranks, the high priest goes before the army, who are all lined. It did tell, describes how they're to be lined in proper array, in form, holding their weapons, so forth, and all the straight lines. And it's lots of description. It goes on 50 pages describing exactly what their deployment of the troops should be. But when they're deployed and ready for battle, the high priest goes out in front of the army, and he walks back and forth, and he pronounces a curse on the enemy land. And that is the Shemama. It's either Shema or Shemama, either one. Shema or Shemama. Or it can call Horeb or Horma, land desolation. See, Horeb is Harb, it's destruction, it's war, it's the Semitic word for war. Or desolation is Horma. But the word it gives here, the word it gives in the Dead Sea Scrolls one, it should be called Shemama, which means desolation. Shema means nothingness, wiping out. And that's what's going to happen. And we're told that when the king of, who is it? Well, this is in the story of David. After his land was cursed, it was called Shemama. But here is where they have this ritual thing. He pronounced all the land, and the other side is the land Barakah. It's the land that's chosen. Now, here's a very interesting thing. In Hebrew, Barakah is to bless, and Barakah is to choose. So Barakah and Barakah, the one means the blessed land, the other means the chosen land. Baruch, you see, Baruch is the blessed one. And the other one is, Baruch means the chosen one. Well, here he calls it the chosen land. We This is referred to in other places, too, in both cases. But this is a remarkable custom. See, it's not in the Bible. You don't find this. Before the war, the high priest dedicates the land to the enemy and calls it desolation. Well, this is a doctrine, you see, of the chosen land, the Baraka. And it's very ancient. It's Yet it makes a lot of the close resemblances between the Roman rules of war and the Hebrew ones here. And that's not accidental because, you know, armies do imitate each other. They have to. You have to compete. If they have a superior uniform for camouflage, you adopt the gray or the green. If they have a helmet that gives better protection, the other side adopts the helmet. So two armies, after a war's been going on for a while, begin to look awfully much alike. You can't allow another person to have an advantage indefinitely. So you do what he does if it's working better than yours. So the armies look alike, and Yadin, who is a tactician, he's a general, he goes into this and he says the Roman follow the same principle. But they divide the world, you see, when they go out to war. The Fekialis, they have the right of the Fekialis. The priests go out and they throw a lance across the border with a curse. They do it seven times here. They do it three times in Rome, the Fekialis. They invite the enemy to submit. See, this is Agorhosticus. It has not been conquered. This is the outside world. This is the world, they would call it the world of darkness, the world of the devil, the A-land. They call it the Elan, the empty land, the desert land. They would cast a spear across it three times, inviting them to submit. If they don't submit, then, of course, they're in a state of rebellion. They're the dark outer world, and they to Rome, they represent a threat. Here are these threats. That's why Rome has to expand. That's why you have to have the world's great empire. You can't leave it the way it is. There's a marvelous Alexander story. There are a great many Alexander stories on this. When he's in India, he did a lot in India, you know, and the wise men, the Brahmins, asked him, why do you conquer the world? He says, I'm not conquering the world, I'm just liberating the world. I'm spreading light and truth. I'm moving into the darkness, you see. And this is the same obsession with the Romans. Oh, we've got to win. As long as those people are unconquered out there, they present a threat to us, you see, because they're ambitious too, and we have stuff they might want. It's always happened. So we have that's called Agorhosticus, and we're Agorpacatus. The part of the two parts of the world, this means the field. This is the fields of the land, you see. Agorhosticus, this is the people that have accepted Rome and therefore are pacified. And the Agorhosticus is those that haven't got room here. They're hostile. They don't want. Oh, this, remember, is the same word as ghost. It's the outer world, ghost, host, same word as guest, a person who comes from afar, a stranger. Guest, host, ghost, hostile, and so forth. And, of course, this is the same theory in Islam. There's Pakadis means Islam, means having submitted, at peace, having accepted. Salam, oh, yes. Right, a simple word. This is the Dar al-Islam. Dar means settled territory. Dar al-Islam, this is the land that has been submitted, that is under God, that has accepted Islam. And if you don't accept Islam, always trouble. We can accept that. So that's Dar al-Harb. See, that's just your Horeb in the Bible, desolation. This is the land desolation. This is Dar al-Harb. Now, this philosophy endures throughout the Book of Mormon, feeling threatened and so forth. And Moroni is under constant pressure for that reason. You see that later on, though. So here we have the, oh, brother, Agorhosticus, Attica, and all this, all these Roman customs. But all this is clearly picked up in the Book of Mormon. I say, you're not going to get this from the Bible or even from the Apocrypha, except now the new things like the Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth. Now, in the 18th verse, he tells that we get the contrast. The cultural contrast is nowhere more clear than in this characterization by Moroni of his own people as we who are despised. Well, the battle scroll of the Dead Sea Scroll starts out with this, by saying this. Let's try here. Yes, the sons of Levi, the sons of Judah, as mentioned before, are exiles in with Galay. They are exiles, in the Galot is the exile. It isn't just the captivity, but they're exiled. They're outcasts in the wilderness. That's the Galut, you see, they call that. They're fight against them, yea, with all their troops, when the exiles of the Son of Light return from the wilderness to encamp in the wilderness of Jerusalem. They're still in Jerusalem. They're still in the wilderness all the time. But they're exiles. They're driven out they're homeless and so forth. It becomes more explicit later on, I think somewhere three and Kirut. Yes, oh, 9, 15, and 13, that's a good one. Describing their condition, it always refers to them in these terms as the, oh, wow. Oh, come on, I got poor people all the way off. They're the Ebionim, they're the poor, they're the outcast, the Ebionim, the poor of God. The best thing would be just to go through these days, go through. Ah, here it is. The high priest shall go forth from the middle in the interval between the space between the lines, the priests, the sons of Aaron, clad in garments of white abyss, and then they shall curse the land desolation and bless the land bountiful. See, the other land, of course, is the land bountiful, the blessed land, the Baruch, and the chosen land. And we get this. Then the best thing is to, just to whip through this. And yes. When war cometh to your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, notice they're being oppressed by the enemy all the way along here. And the faint heart, the men of valor, and you shall be saved from your enemies, and then thou hast chosen for thyself from all the nations of the lands the people of men, holy through the covenant, taught the statutes, enlightened in understanding, hearing the glorious voices. Now, this is not the language that the Jews accept today at all. They say this is apocalyptic, this is eschatological language, and we don't go for that. We're strictly historical. We believe, as I say, Yadin saying, my religion is the land, and then he's saying, we don't believe in miracles, but we count on them. Those strictly Jewish cons. But when you get a passage like this, you realize that this is, they don't like this, and he doesn't like this at all. Yadin doesn't. Thyself from a land of men holy through the covenant, taught the statutes, enlightened in understanding, hearing the glorious voices, seeing holy angels, open of ear, understanding deep things, even the mysteries. And then it goes into cosmology, which the Jews are supposed to lead alone. The Talmud says it was better a man was not born that he should bring up subjects like this. But then he goes into this sort of thing, and he says the domination of the spirits of the expanse of the skies, the host of the luminaries, the stars, the domain of the spirits and the holy, and the dominion of the holy ones, the treasures of glory. He hath created the earth and its boundaries of her divisions, into the wilderness and the plain land that all the springs bring. Well, this goes into your cosmological, Kabbalistic doctrine that's supposed to be, that is rejected by the rabbis after the fall of the temple. And the Book of Mormon is full of it. And then here it talk about being redeemed. The Hapil Galo Thebeli Al, in the, where it talks about, thou mayest be honored by our enemies by felling the troops of the seven nations of vanity by the hand of the poor ones that are to be redeemed by thee. They describe themselves as the poor ones. The Ebionim right here. See, that's what he's talking about. When Alma says, surely God will not allow that we who are despised because we take upon us the name of Christ. See, they think of themselves as the despised one, and it's the same thing here. When they go out, notice he's saying this while he's waving this flag, while he's waving the banners. And this is on the banners here that they're talking about. He's talking about by the hand of the poor ones that are to be redeemed by thee with power and retribution, for wondrous might the heart shall be a door of hope. And then, here again, the next section, 15 begins, for into the land of the poor ones wilt thou deliver the enemies from all, into the hand of the poor ones. Again, he describes himself, he calls them that, to see who thou hast delivered the enemies from all lands, into the hands of them that are prostrate in the dust. He describes them as the poor ones, as prostrate in the dust. An expression, remember, that King Benjamin uses? Again, you won't find that in the Bible. But here the king comes out, you are less than the dust, even in the dust, remember? And then he says, when he asks the people to submit and accept the law, he says, prostrate yourself even in the dust. And here it describes Israel that way, when he's waving his banner around. He says, for into the hand of the poor ones thou wilt deliver the enemies from all lands, into the hands of them that are prostrate in the dust, so as to bring low all mighty men of the nations, to render the recompense to the wicked upon the head of thine enemies, and so forth. For truly, thy truth upon all the sons of men. And needless to say, the Messiah passages are the one the Jews don't like. As I say, the Dead Sea Scrolls are in bad repute, both with Christians and Jews, because there's too much Christianity in them. The Jews say, they're anticipating Christianity. We don't like that. And the Christians say this robs us of our originality. We're having those things there when they shouldn't have them. And then the Levites, the elders, shall bless people from where they stand, the God of Israel and all his true deeds. And they shall curse all the spirits of Belial in his place, and solemnly declare, notice, they shall bless the people where they stand, and they shall curse the people of Belial when they stand. There, as he says, he pronounced all the land to the south of them desolation, and all the other land he pronounced a blessing on it. He uses those two words for blessing. All the spirits of his lot in the same place, and they shall solemnly declare this, and bless God of Israel for his holy plan. Again, they're always referring to plans. Do you know the word plan isn't found in the King James Bible? An amazing thing. We think in terms of plan all the time. That's been picked up by most churches today. They planned a great deal. They didn't before. They thought that was one of the follies of Mormonism. Here's another one, and then let's see, it's 7. And have been brought low. Yes, through the poor in spirit, there shall be a gnawing of the hard heart. And the hard hearted, again, it's a favorite theme with Alma, it's the hardness of their hearts, as you've known that. And through them that are upright, the way of all the wicked shall come to an end. And thy mercy is upon the remnants of Israel. They're in the dominion, of course. The Book of Mormon is all a theme of remnant. Remnant is the theme of the Book of Mormon, again. They think of themselves as the remnant. Thy name shall exalt thy mighty acts forever at the turning points of epochs and the appointed times of ordained things for eternity, as well as the coming of daytime and the coming of nighttime. These are dispensations it's talking about. And there's the Magnificat. And then he says here, all their assembled multitude is of chaff that passes away. Well, that's right from the first song. Kamutz asher tet penu ruach. Chaff that the wind blows away. This is the wicked congregation, what will happen to them. And all their assembled multitude is as chaff that passes away, and it shall become a desolation and shall not be found. Shall whisper from the dust, the Book of Mormon says, and they shall whisper lowly from the dust. Their mighty ones are no more, and so forth, Book of Mormon. But here again, you see, is they've changed places there, and all the rest has vanished away like smoke, and all their assembled multitude is as chaff, and it shall become a desolation and shall not be found. The wicked congregations of darkness. What's this one up here? All his brethren shall walk. Yes, the priest, it says here, the priest destined for the appointed time of all his brethren shall walk along and strengthen their hands for battle, and he shall solemnly declare, be strong and courageous. This is exactly what Moroni does. It's a priestly office to do this. Well, here we get another one. The chief priest shall come forward and stand in front of the formation and shall strengthen their heart through the might of God and their hands for his battle. So this is the same procedure we find then in the battle scroll, IQM, as we mentioned before. It's all called cave number one, Qumran, Milchama, meaning the battle scroll. And this brings all these things to life all of a sudden. Nobody had any idea that this was part of the Jewish tradition. He's just beginning here. I see the time is up. But now he goes on and tells them a wonderful story. We'll mention this the next time. But this is, this is another point. This is number 7, I would say. Yes, then the next thing he does, that's very important too. So you may be as flustered and confused as I am here, because of the richness of this evidence that's thrown out. It's so compact. There's so much here that we never looked at before. But it's all there. It all has significance. There are tracers all the way through this, and this is the thing you're supposed to look for that can't be faked. Think of what Joseph has given us here. Well, we'll resume later.